Thanks for tuning in for the Book Club at 91.7 on WVXU. I'm Mark Purcell. Glad to have you along this morning. It was just past 11 o'clock on the morning of August 9th, 1945, 3 days after the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, that the United States dropped a second atomic bomb on Nagasaki, a small port city on Japan's southernmost island. An estimated 74,000 people died in the first 5 months. Another 75,000 were injured, and for decades after, the effects of radiation led to many more deaths and life-altering medical conditions. The trial and tribulations of survivors of Nagasaki are profiled in a new book from Susan Southard. It's called Nagasaki: Life After Nuclear War. Susan, welcome to the Book Club at 91.7.
Thank you so much, Mark.
So here on the 70th anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki, why did you feel it was important to share the stories of these five survivors?
You know, really, we have a very, generally speaking in the United States, we have a very abstract idea about what happened when the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You know, we have the image of the mushroom cloud, which has kind of become iconic. But what happened beneath the mushroom cloud, especially in not only the first days, months, and the first year, which was partially chronicled by John Hersey's really amazing and enduring book, Hiroshima, the long-term effects, as you mentioned, went on and still continue today and have affected the survivors of both Hiroshima and Nagasaki in very profound ways. And I thought it was very important for us as Americans to understand the whole picture there.
I also believe I read an article recently in USA Today that talked about the race to try to capture these memories from these survivors, because that was 70 years ago, and many of these survivors are beginning to pass, and getting their stories down is important, as you point out more than once in the book, to keep a city from being bombed again.
Yes, you know, in Nagasaki and in Hiroshima, the youngest survivors are 70 years old, and those survivors would have been too young to have vivid memories of the early years. And so the survivors in my book, they were all teenagers at the time of the bombing, are now in their mid to late 80s. They're coming to the end of their lives, and there is a really serious effort going on in Nagasaki, and I imagine similarly in Hiroshima, to capture their testimonies and their stories on videotape, so that it will be, they will be able to be carried forward in history. And also, very interestingly, in Nagasaki, people who want to help carry the stories forward are being trained to tell the stories of specific survivors in the survivors' own words, with accompanied by images that are specific to that survivor's life. So I think that's a really interesting way. And they're very concerned about the loss of the stories.
I'm speaking with Susan Southard. She's the author of Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War, tracing five survivors of the bombing of Nagasaki in August of 1945, the second atomic bomb the United States dropped on Japan. You can learn more about it at our website, wvxu.org. And you make it clear in the beginning of the book, Susan, that you're not going to explore the political ramifications. This was really is a book more about the effect on the people and how people dealt with this, both the day of and afterwards. And that's something I felt as I was reading was something I hadn't encountered before. And that was the persecution and the like that the survivors of these atomic bomb blasts had in the years after the war.
Yes, I was really surprised about that component of the story as well. Many of the survivors who were disfigured experienced really quite severe discrimination, both publicly, you know, in social environments, getting stared at, getting looks of disgust or disdain. Some of them had difficult time getting hired by employers. In fact, all survivors struggled with both employment and marriage because their status as survivors, particularly as it relates to their exposure to that whole body radiation, brought into question their long-term health. And so employers didn't want to hire them, and potential marriage partners didn't want to marry them, and also because of the genetic effects, the feared genetic effects on their children. So all in all, those who didn't have physical disfigurement mostly kept their status silent. They did not tell people. Those who were, of course, physically burned and whose scars showed could not avoid that.
I was one of the few times I smiled while reading your book, Nagasaki, was when one of the people, one of the survivors that you follow, gets married and finds out, despite the fact that that they haven't told their spouse-to-be, their spouse was also an atomic bomb survivor. And I found it, it very surprising there that, that the marriage went through, the arranged marriage went through, and that these two people found themselves despite that discrimination.
Yes. Well, I would say the majority of survivors did end up marrying, but the process of getting married and who they married changed often because of their status as survivors. And you're right, that moment of discovery when, because they've kept their status hidden, the moment of discovery, at some point something happens where they both realize that they were survivors. And but even, I have to say, even throughout their lives, many survivors really didn't say a great deal about their experiences, primarily because it was far too traumatic to bring up.
But
so
beyond,
there was a lot of silence.
A lot of silence. Well, beyond their physical and emotional struggles, what other kind of discrimination did these survivors encounter?
Well, I think now there's definitely support and sympathy. And I think most of the discrimination came within their own communities. You know, most people in Japan at the time, at the end of the war, remained in their cities, shockingly. Many did move away in order to be in a safe place, but many stayed. Or after the city began to rebuild, they returned. And the discrimination that I discovered was happening within the city itself. I don't have a lot of knowledge about discrimination outside of Nagasaki, except one of the survivors did move away in a very rebellious, strong decision to leave Nagasaki in order to eventually pursue a career in Tokyo. And she had been really seriously injured and irradiated, and for 10 years she had lost her hair, and her hair didn't grow back, so she had remained in hiding. But in Tokyo, she didn't tell anybody. And when the time for a potential marriage opportunity came, she knew that by telling, and she did tell the man that she was a survivor, and she could see his reaction, and she withdrew her consideration of marriage to him right away because she couldn't stand the idea of being seen that way.
So you follow the lives of five survivors of the bombing in your book, Nagasaki. Why did you decide to follow these particular people, and what do you feel these stories, these individual stories, reveal that that other books about the atomic bombs have not?
Well, I decided to write about the five survivors, and incidentally for your listeners, the story is really the entire city's story with these five survivors' individual experiences woven out throughout, so you get to follow their lives all the way across seven decades. I decided to focus on five survivors because, and I could have chosen more, but it would have been too much for a reader to keep track of, because each individual man, woman, and child beneath the atomic cloud had a unique experience, even though you can kind of give an overarching view. They each had a unique experience physically with their families, with their post-war lives. So I felt like the five survivors I chose each had very different kinds of experiences, and the atomic bomb's impact on their lives were different. So that's why I chose the five. And what I hope that readers will get is a very intimate experience of a very epic story that hasn't been told before, so that the impression of nuclear war becomes specific and personal, as opposed to a larger kind of massive war story.
Speaking with Susan Southard, author of Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. And you said that this book is as much about the city as it is about these five survivors. And I was delightfully surprised at how quick Nagasaki bounced back after the attack. The pictures in the book, you talk about the healing and the replacement of the infrastructure. And it seems like less than a decade after the bombing, Nagasaki was well on its way to recovery.
Well, it was, as far as the city goes, you know, within a few years, there was beginning to be temporary housing built in the ruins for those thousands of people whose homes had been destroyed, and they had to replace everything. The water system, everything was destroyed through a large portion of the city, and I was surprised by that as well. What the recovery of the city doesn't tell is what's happening with those survivors who are still hidden away because they're so ill with the symptoms of radiation-related diseases, or who are suffering the trauma or who are dealing with extraordinary loss of entire families, and they're the only ones who are still alive, that continued on as the city rebuilt. It's a remarkable story of survival, yes, and determination and courage and endurance beyond anything I have ever known.
Another surprise I had while reading Nagasaki was the reaction to the bombing. You make mention how President Truman makes an address, a day after Nagasaki was bombed, and does not mention that the second atomic bomb is dropped. He only mentions Hiroshima.
Yes, isn't that amazing? My guess is that speech was written in advance, and at the time they didn't know exactly which day the Nagasaki bomb would be dropped, because it was included as part of one large military directive to drop the bombs as they were ready, as opposed to a second specific military directive for the second bombing. And there was a lot of denial in the United States about the radiation effects. General Groves, who was the director of the Manhattan Project, where the bomb was developed, you know, categorically denied that reports out of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were about the radiation effects and the horrific symptoms and massive cycles of death that were going on in the two cities. You know, he categorically denied those stories. And there was censorship both in Japan under U.S. occupation policies that ultimately prohibited stories of the atomic bombing even to be released in Japan, but also in the United States, the media outlets were requested to not publish stories about the atomic bombing, primarily out of fear that another country might pick up on certain details and be able to speed along their own development of a nuclear weapon. But the ultimate outcome of that was that Americans at the time ended up not really getting almost any part of the radiation story.
It's an unflinching account and quite a tale, very thought-provoking. Thank you for sharing, and thank you for taking the time to talk to me this morning, Susan.
Thank you so much, Mark. I really appreciate it.
Susan Southard, the author of Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. It was 70 years ago tomorrow that the United States dropped a second atomic bomb on the small port city of Nagasaki on Japan's southernmost island. You can learn more about the book and Susan's work at our website, wvxu.org. This is the Book Club at 91.7.
have a book or author to recommend to the book club at 91.7? A question to ask, a comment, or story to share? Email book at wvxu.org. That's right, book at wvxu.org. You can also be part of the conversation on the Book Club at 91.7 page at wvxu.org or on WVXU's Facebook page on the Book Club tab. We love talking about books and hearing about books you've discovered online at wvxu.org, on Facebook, and on email, book at wvxu.org. Thanks.